come to think of it, you know, after each concert, once he knew what Puddett is, he gave an Irish concert. I mean, he'd get out there first and he'd give you all the Mozarts and the Handels and everything else. And when you get all finished with that, his concert was over. And then he started off with The Meeting of the Waters. Every song from then on was Irish. And you know that nobody would leave the place. They used to look to hear him sing those numbers.
Could you remember any more of those Irish songs?
But that he sang? Oh, yeah, I had him sing Macushla down there one night, and the sweat poured out of me.
I feel them in a folding, caressing me still. Fling them out in the darkness, my lost love of Macushla. Let them find me and find me.
There of John McCormack in New York, from John Toohey of the Bronx, who went to America over 60 years ago from his native Cork. Now, John McCormack went to the United States as an opera singer. That was in 1909, and he was brought there with the help of Tex Zini and was taken on as a tenor by Oscar Hammerstein at the old Manhattan Opera House. Now, during the summer, I met in Washington, D.C., Calvin LeCompte, who is the music director of the WGMS radio station in Washington, and also a music teacher and a great judge of voices. And he remembers McCormack, and his father before him was a great fan, but I asked him if he... Calvin McCompte had ever, in fact, heard McCormack.
Yes, I did. My grandfather was a great lover of music and a great collector of records. And among his many recordings, of course, were those of John McCormack from his earlier days on. When I was quite young, I was taken to hear McCormack sing. First here, and then later, I believe it was in Philadelphia. The second time, I was a little older. Now, in the course of my career, if you can call it that, I've been a voice coach and a vocal technician. And I remember the perfection of McCormack's voice in his youth, the extraordinary breath control, the wonderful ability he had to sing ornaments and make them part of the line. The vowels were always very, very clear, in brogue, of course, but still clear and pure. So that the voice carried beautifully over an orchestra as well as in an auditorium with just a piano. But more than that, there was a certain warmth in his singing. And for all the clarity of his vowels, and I might add the way he had with consonants, which was extraordinary, he never broke the line with a consonant. The consonant was always part of the line, and that's something I wish I could get many singers to do today. With all of that, there was also an extraordinary identification with the material. He was a great interpreter. He certainly was not much of an actor, I'm told. I never saw him on the operatic stage, but I did hear him sing operatic arias with an orchestra. And I remember that if you closed your eyes, you could hear the operatic intensity in the voice. They tell me that on the operatic stage, he simply stood there and sang and did very little else. But does it matter when we have such extraordinary recordings from him, when we can hear the beauty of the line? Paul Hume tells me that on occasion, McCormick was known to have sung such heavy roles as Othello and was very interested in singing Tristan. And at one point I thought, goodness, that must not be true. But the more I think about it, the more I realize that though the voice was not an enormous one, the purity of the vowels and the perfection of the placement would allow him to be heard, even through the thickest orchestration. He reminds me in that respect a little bit of Tito Schipa, who also had the extraordinary ability to take a relatively small voice and come right through an orchestra and be heard superbly. I suppose McCormick was, for me, and still is, a model of bel canto singing. I've known some singers who can sing Il mio tesoro from Don Giovanni just about as well as he, but I've never known anyone to surpass the perfection of that recording.
E soldi stati a marmi, non ti ho voglia tornar, non ti ho voglia tornar, e soldi stati a marmi, non ti ho voglia tornar, sì. Non si voglia tornar.
By the way, in 1913, McCormack sang the part of Don Ottavio in Don Giovanni under Felix Weingartner in Boston. And after Il Mio Tesoro, Weingartner was moved to put down his baton and applaud. In fact, years later, he told Charles L. Wagner, who was McCormack's manager, that that was the first time he had ever heard the role of Don Ottavio really sung. Now, what kind of musical world did McCormack come into before the First World War, and indeed a musical world that lasted into the 20s and the early 30s? Well, last summer I went down to the old part of New York, Lower Manhattan on the east side, East 10th Street, and there I met Philip Miller in a lovely old apartment where he's surrounded by his great collection of records and musical memorabilia and instruments, photographs, and so on. Philip Miller was formerly chief of the music division of the New York Public Library, which harbors a huge music collection. He's now retired, but was able to tell me about that musical life in New York when he came back there from his studies himself in 1924. This was, of course, the musical life in which John McCormack flourished. And he told me, first of all, about the recital halls that were there at that time.
In those days, of course, there were, originally there were three principal halls. Aeolian Hall, which was where the City University now is, across from the library on 42nd Street. And Town Hall, which is just a block over on 43rd Street, which became the principal place for recitals, which Aeolian Hall had been up to that point. And then there was Carnegie, and there still is, thank the Lord. And that, of course, is for the orchestras. And, of course, people still give recitals there, which is a little unfortunate. Of course, I was there the other night for Dame Janet Baker. She can fill the hall, so of course she does, but it would be nicer to hear her in a smaller place. But that's...
Well, now, coming to John McCormack, that was the kind of musical world he came into when he came to America first.
Yes, well, of course, he came originally to the Manhattan Opera. But he found out very quickly, and I suppose he suspected it from the beginning, that really he wanted to sing songs. That was more his style than the opera, although, of course, he was successful. There was no question of that, but more than successful. But there was, at that time, another hall, the Hippodrome, which was an enormous place up on 6th Avenue at 43rd Street. And McCormack, Tetrazzini, and Caruso, singers of really big reputation who could fill that place, did. I never heard a recital there. There was a big variety show that went on continuously, and I did go to the Hippodrome several times. It finally ended up as popular priced opera. You could go for 25 cents and see this, well, practically unrehearsed opera, but sometimes it came out rather well and was certainly worth 25 cents. And they had some quite well-known people there. But that's, of course, later.
The Hippodrome, not there anymore.
No, they took that down, I think, in the 30s. There was a parking lot for a while. Now there's a building there. And, well, it's kind of sad that these things go.
And then Philip Miller in New York spoke about the great days of the old Metropolitan Opera, just the old one now, which is no longer there, and of the people associated with it.
I just missed Caruso, unfortunately. I did, my first opera was the year before he died. No, yes, about a year before he died. That was Carmen on Thanksgiving Day, and Geraldine Farrar was the prima donna, and she was, of course, one of the great attractions at the Met. Martinelli sang the Don Jose, and that was a pretty good start. After that, I heard Aida with Emmy Destin. She was in her last season here, and I heard a great favorite of mine was Matzenauer, who sang for years originally as a contralto. She later sang soprano roles, but she had a magnificent voice and was a very fine artist. As I say, Martinelli was the tenor after Caruso. Of course, we had also Gigi. We had quite a stable of first-rate tenors. Edward Johnson, who was later the manager of the house, was a tenor in my early days, and a very good one. He didn't have as great a voice as some of the Italians, but he was a very fine artist. And you may remember there was a point somewhere in the late 20s, I think, when John McCormick was quoted as, he was asked, who was the greatest tenor? And he said, Edward Johnson. And Edward Johnson was taken by surprise, and so he gave out to the papers that returned the compliment, you know, the way they did. And that was one of the happier notes of relations. Well, of course, McCormick and Caruso also were great friends and exchanged compliments. And I'm not quite sure how much of that goes on now.
Well, coming down specifically to McCormick, you saw him perform.
Yes, I did. I heard him in recital, and I heard him with the Philharmonic. I think it was a benefit for the pension fund, which they used to do. I should check this up and then know exactly. And it must have been Mengelberg conducting. It would have been at that time. And McCormick, what I remember was that he sang several songs of Hugo Wolf with orchestra.
Thank you.
part of the Hugo Wolf song there. And indeed, I believe it was McCormack's favorite, and called, well, of course, sung in German. In English, it's called The Sleeping Christ Child. In New York, I met Monsignor Philip Shannon, who is the pastor in Scarsdale, just outside New York City. We met on the Irish Consul General's office in Manhattan, looking down on St. Patrick's Cathedral, just at Fifth Avenue, St. Patrick's Cathedral, where, in fact, Monsignor Shannon was ordained many, many years ago. He was born in the city itself around 67th Street, and remembers McCormack, John McCormack, well. In fact, I asked him if he had ever been to a McCormack concert.
Yes, I was at one concert of John McCormack's, and that was a thrill of my life. Could I tell you something about it? I was at a concert in Carnegie Hall just last March, and the concert artist was Frank Patterson. And that concert was to observe the centenary of John McCormack. And they mentioned on the stage, Frank Patterson mentioned that John McCormack had appeared on that stage just 50 years ago, his final concert in New York. And it occurred to me that I was there in that concert hall 50 years ago. And I'd like to tell you just something about it. I brought my aunt, Auntie Kate, with me. My mother's aunt. She was quite elderly and a very large woman, and a woman who was not easily thwarted, I might say. And we went down to Carnegie Hall. We went down by subway from the Bronx. And I was so happy and thrilled, you know, to the opportunity to hear John McCormack in concert. And when we got to Carnegie Hall, we had balcony seats. But Auntie Kate was a strong-willed woman, and she insisted upon going up the middle aisle. And she had a cane, and I think she waved it a bit. And the ushers there made sure that Auntie Kate got a seat. But I was very much impressed by John McCormack, the real professional. He never once looked at Auntie Kate. That would have drawn attention to her. But sang, he was probably singing an aria from Mozart or Handel. And I was so enthralled, I went up into the balcony, of course, somewhere. But that was a great evening in my life as a young American, 17 years of age.
Monsignor Philip Shannon of Scarsdale, New York, with the last word to John Toohey of the Bronx, who heard McCormack in the old huge hippodrome which Philip Miller mentioned just a short time ago.
The first time, when I got here in 1926, John gave a concert, and it was down in the old hippodrome. Remember the old hippodrome?
Yes, indeed.
And that was a big place. It held 5,000 people. So I took a shot. I went down there. I couldn't get a ticket. So I waited in the round. And waited. All of a sudden, this girl inside the window says, go upstairs to the top balcony. Well, you were up in heaven when you were up there. And she sold me the ticket, and I went up, and I got one seat. When I looked down, I couldn't see McCormack, but I could hear him sing. That voice floated up to him.
That was the first of two programs on John McCormick in America, recorded and presented by Kieran McMahona in this, the centenary year. The second program can be heard at the same time next Sunday morning.
He acted with the singing because he was an actor with the voice, not in the same way that Shelley Oppen was an actor with the voice, but in the kind of subtle characterization, the narrative singing, the folk songs, just incredible. Gordon Ledbetter said that McCormick's art was like cut glass. Very subtle thing. Shades and lights and colors. Father Finn of the Paulus Choristers in St. Paul's here in New York referred to McCormick's voice as light coming through stained glass windows of variated colors.
Lads and lasses, to your places, up the middle and down again. Oh, the merry hearted laughter ring through the happy glen. Oh, to think of it, oh, to dream of it, fills my heart with peace. Oh, the days of the kerry dancing, oh, the ring of the piper's tune. Oh, for one of those hours of gladness, gone, alas, like our youth. Happy years are dead, and one by one the merry hearts are fled. Silent now is the wild and the lonely glen, where the bright glad laughs will echo ne'er again. Of old companions stealing out of the past once more, and the sound of the dear old music soft and sweet as in days of yore. When the boys began to gather in the glen of a summer night, and the kerry piper puny made a flower with wild delight. Oh, to think of it, oh, to dream of it, fills my heart with fear. Oh, the days of the kerry dancing, oh,
the ring of the timer's tune. Oh, for one of those hours of gladness gone, alas, like our youth.
The Kerry Dance was recorded by John McCormack in 1916 in Camden, New Jersey. And we heard the comment in the middle there from Peter F. Dolan, who is Secretary of the John McCormack Society of America. Now, there's no doubt about it. It was in America that McCormack really rose to fame. These triumphant years were in the States. First of all, there's an opera singer from 1909 in the old Manhattan Opera House in New York, but then particularly as a recitalist, as a solo recitalist, traveling around the country, generally with his accompanist Teddy Schneider and his manager Dennis McSweeney. Now, Peter Dolan, who is the secretary of the John McCormack Society, has written a lot and done a tremendous research into McCormack in America. And he says that it was under the management of Charles L. Wagner, beginning in the autumn of 1912, that John McCormack was launched on a meteoric rise to fame. In the 13 years with Wagner and his associate Dennis F. McSweeney, McCormack piled up a record of gross receipts that would mark him as the greatest concert attraction in history. In their first season together, McCormack sang 67 recitals, and over 90% of these were to capacity or more than capacity audiences. John McCormack and Christmas are annual events, soon became Wagner's advertising slogan to the trade. And Peter Dolan, when I spoke to him in New York last May, way up above Fifth Avenue, and there was a traffic noise down below, he mentioned some of the places that McCormack, where McCormack traveled.
He was singing 10 times in New York at this time. And that necessitated an entirely new program each time he would come back to New York City after a tour to the West or the South, or Canada, or the Northwest, or singing in places like Keokuk, Iowa, Holdridge, Nebraska, Ripon, Wisconsin, Hutchinson, Kansas, where people would come for hundreds and hundreds of miles to hear him.
Oh,
Lancashire's by Bizet. Many people who spoke to came back to the time when McCormick was singing in the old Hippodrome in New York, which was a huge hall holding over 5,000 people. Peter Dolan, in his researches, found that McCormick was giving 10 concerts a season in the old Hippodrome. And he came to the stage that having filled all those 5,000 or 6,000 seats, then had to put people even onto the stage. And this never bothered McCormick. He was very easygoing and didn't mind people sitting around him and almost touching him. And John Tuig, a grand old man who was from Cork, who we've heard before, and lives in the Bronx, he remembers one of these occasions.
He even sold the stage. And there's a time that I couldn't get in. I bought a ticket and sat up next to him. I could shake hands with him.
They would put seats on the stage?
They put seats on the stage, they would.
Mm. You never actually met him?
Well, I was close to him at the Monsignor. I could have shook hands with him.
And we spoke to the tenor's son, Cyril Count McCormick, and now living in retirement in County Wicklow. I was going to say living a quiet life, but indeed on this, the centenary year of his father's birth, he had anything but a quiet life. Cyril was in America and was a Grand Marshal of the St. Patrick's Day Parade in Washington, D.C., and had a whole round of events and appointments and dinners in honor of his father. But he does remember the early days when he was very young, when his father was in America. Of course, he didn't travel around with him all the time because, naturally enough, he had to go to school. But he does remember those days in the old Hippodrome with the people sitting on the stage around his father.
He hated disappointing people, and then he found that a lot of people were being turned away. He had a brainwave, and he got the management of the various theatres to put seats on the stage. And he always sang at least one song with his back to the audience facing the stage. That I can remember. And he'd bow to the audience and say, "With your permission." And then he'd turn around and sing to the people on the stage.
Lord,
the 1914-18 war, he decided he wanted to do something to as a contribution towards it. So he did a tour of the United States from coast to coast, and he gave the proceeds of every concert that he sang entirely to the Red Cross and paid all his traveling and hotel expenses out of his pocket while he was doing that tour. And he finished up with a concert in the Hippodrome in New York, and if I'm not mistaken, it was the biggest individual take in any concert ever in the Hippodrome in New York.
Sir Count McCormick. And as I said, because of the tenor's very heavy schedule and of his traveling all over the States, his son and his daughter and his dear wife, Lily, didn't see all that much of him, and certainly during the concert season. But they did, of course, have great times together during the summers, and I asked Cyril if he had memories of those days.
Quite a few. I can remember two different apartments that my mother and my father had in New York, and I can remember three different summer houses that he rented, and then finally he bought. And they were on Long Island Sound. And he did two recreations in the summertime, and I used to be included in them, were playing tennis and sailing on Long Island Sound and fishing. And he finally finished up with a very nice cabin cruiser on which we could all, the men of the family used to go out and possibly stay away. And on one occasion, I went from Long Island Sound to Camden, New Jersey, by water. And we lived aboard while Father was making records in, at that time, the Victor Talkie Machine Company in Camden, New Jersey.
That would be about?
That would be about 1918, or maybe 18 or 19.
And here now is a part of a recording made by McCormick in Camden, New Jersey, for the Victor Studios. This was made in April 1920. One of his favorite songs, Handel, O Sleep, Why Dost Thou Leave Me?
Yeah.
But why was John McCormack so popular in America, and indeed here in Ireland? Of course, there was the great voice. That was the basic attraction. But was there something deeper? Was there some significance, particularly amongst the Irish Americans, which attracted them to McCormack's concert? Dr. Colin Owens is of a later generation, not the McCormack generation. Dr. Owens is Associate Professor of Irish and American Literature in George Mason University in Washington, and he tries to explain this attraction that McCormack had.
McCormack, it seems to me, exemplified many of the virtues that we associate with the emerging independent Ireland. The values of family, faith, the rural life and its various qualities, extolled most pointedly by De Valera in his many statements about the ideals which underlay the free state. McCormack is more popular in Ireland as well as in Irish America than other figures such as Joyce, Yeats, O'Casey, for several reasons, which I'm sure we all understand. His choice of subject, as in mid-career he changed from a career of operatic singing to a concert career, which embraced both the traditional songs, at least the Victorian interpretations of those, Moore particularly, along with the repertoire of the concert stage, leader and operatic selections. But he is best remembered, or most widely remembered, for his songs, which represent or recreate that those virtues and that way of life, which I mentioned, the songs of nostalgia for a rural quietude and a life of faith and embodying family virtues and all that. He seems to me that one of the explanations for why he's so popular here as well, or was during that period, in the 20s and 30s particularly, was because he embodied for Irish America a link between the best in those traditions which had been left behind by the famine immigrants, and the achievement of an Irishman in the world of, in the grand world, the large world of artistic achievement. That apparently linked, I would imagine, with the feelings among Irish Americans of a second generation with their own success in this country. They're coming of age. They're joining the large urban middle class with more cultivated tastes, at the same time retaining those links with the traditions that they had left behind.
Dr. Colin Owens of George Mason University in Washington. Patrick Hayes is a concert impresario in Washington, D.C., former manager of the National Symphony Orchestra, very much involved in Irish-American affairs and associations, and very, very much involved indeed with the John McCormack centenary. And he reminded us of an occasion way back in the 1920s.
In 1928, he sang a recital before a large audience of thousands in a place no longer standing called the Old Auditorium. He sang without fee, and all the proceeds went toward the building fund of the National Shrine. That planted our thinking northeast, where the shrine is located, adjacent to the grounds of the Catholic University. Similarly, when all of our dinners and celebrations are over, 10 and 50 years from now, you will see and walk on John McCormack Avenue, and students will benefit from a scholarship fund we're setting up in John's name at Catholic University.
Patrick Hayes. But finally, a word from Cyril Count McCormack about his mother, about Lily, the gracious wife of John McCormack.
She was a very, very wonderful wife to him. In fact, a lot of us say that she was, to a great extent, she was a very, very great help in his whole career. Very lovely, wonderful lady.
Like the rose that's grown in a music lawn, and the feather she's no longer fair. But she's like Amore, se vuol tu, amor di fibra per più.